Welcome back to Critic Proof. I'm Alyssa Rosenberg, your host and the culture blogger at Think Progress and a columnist at Slate and The Atlantic. And I am joined today by one of my favorite writers and a colleague of mine at The Atlantic. I've never gotten to do this before, so it's very exciting. Introduce yourself.
Hey, my name is Kevin Fallon. I'm a reporter for The Daily Beast, and I also do columns for The Atlantic. And it's great to finally talk to you.
Yay! It's very exciting, especially since we are here to talk about Skyfall, the new James Bond movie that is, like, honestly, I think one of my favorite movies of the year, which I would not have anticipated going into it.
Yeah, definitely the best Bond movie there's ever been, and I agree, one of the best movies this year so far.
What did you think of it in relation to Casino Royale, the first movie where Daniel Craig was James Bond? Because they seem to me to be sort of equally good executions of very different takes on the franchise. Casino Royale is a very sort of controlled, to a certain extent, fairly tight movie, where Skyfall is sort of all over the place, in a way that I really enjoyed, but I think it is all over the place.
Yeah, I think Casino Royale was very focused on reinventing and reinvigorating the franchise. Mm. So it sort of took it extremely dark and moody. And what I loved about Skyfall was all the winking homages to, you know, the classic Bond. And it got to be a little bit more playful in that way that Casino Royale wasn't. It just made it more enjoyable for me as a Bond fan.
you talked about sort of reinventing the Bond franchise, and obviously Craig came in at a point when the Bond franchise had become sort of very campy, definitely didn't take itself particularly seriously, but also just sort of, you know, almost seemed to be in its dotage, right? Like, by the time anything reaches sort of self-parody and self-referentiality, you have to think that it's out of ideas. And one of the things that really stood out for me in Casino Royale, and that I think is sort of extended productively here in Skyfall in a way it wasn't in Quantum of Solace. Pause. What did you think of Quantum of Solace, the Bond movie?
Oh. I did not care for it.
I feel like it says a lot that I just can't remember any of it, right? I mean, I feel like there's Peru and, like, salt mines or something.
I mean, that's exactly it. Like, Casino Royale, everyone remembers for, you know, sort of putting the shot in the arm to the Bond franchise, and Skyfall is just spectacular, and then, you know, Quantum of Solace happened, and it's just so hard to think of anything distinctive about it other than the fact that it wasn't that enjoyable.
Well, and it gets at something that I was about to say, which is that Casino Royale really sort of, I thought, redefined Bond's relationships with women. And Judi Dench had been playing M as sort of towards the end of the Pierce Brosnan era, and, you know, she was set up as someone who sort of couldn't stand Bond, thought he was sort of sexist, a relic. And in Casino Royale, it was sort of reinvented as this, you know, teacher with a naughty but bright pupil. And then, you know, and so much of Skyfall is just about, you know, Bond's relationship to M and Bond's relationship, or and M's relationships to her, sort of her, you know, sort of bright young male agents, period. And it was the first, I mean, I feel like this is the first Bond movie where Bond has been capable of being friends with a woman. You know, because I think he and M, they're, you know, sort of maternal dynamics, but I think they are straight up friends.
Yeah, no, definitely. And, you know, that's, I think, one of the reasons why Skyfall stood out above the rest of the Bond films is because of the way that relationship is explored in a deeper way than it's ever been done. You know, that there was a whole emotional and poignant through line through Skyfall, which I've never seen in a Bond movie before. Where that, you know, intimacy is explored, and, you know, that's a credit to Judi Dench, who finally, you know, gets to exercise some acting muscles in the film.
Yeah.
And not, you know, not just be Judi Dench as M, she gets to actually portray a character. And I think that relationship is just one of the key aspects of Skyfall's success.
Well, and it was also nice to have his relationship with the woman who's revealed to be Eve Moneypenny. I feel like this is the first time we've ever seen a woman. I mean, I guess this is true in Casino Royale as well. But you have two women who are not necessarily particularly interested in sleeping with Bond when they first meet him. And Vesper Lynd ultimately does sleep with Bond. But Moneypenny doesn't, and sort of counter particularly to the 90s depiction of her, where she's sort of lovelorn crazy for Bond, you know, I'm not sure she wants to sleep with him at all. I'm not sure she's interested.
I got the vibe that she definitely did, and you know, and that's what I kind of liked. Like I said before, the you know, taking Skyfall took Bond somewhere new, but still recalled a lot of the old classic Bond, you know, tropes. I thought this Moneypenny character was a big part of that, where you know she was the you know the sexy Bond girl that you need to have in a Bond movie. And I thought there was a definite sexual attraction there that you kind of want between Bond and his female comrades.
Well, I mean, I felt like, I mean, I certainly, they're, you know, sort of attractive people who have potential chemistry, but there's that moment in the scene in Macau where she's shaving him with a straight razor and he starts unbuttoning her blouse and she stops him. And it's, I mean, maybe it's that she's attracted to him, but it's a case where maybe she's more sort of, she has that part of their relationship almost more under control than he does, I thought.
Yeah, she was definitely in control, which is another thing I liked about her character. She's a very strong Bond girl. She wasn't just there to be, you know, sexy and, you know, femme fatale or whatever. But the sexual energy was still there, which I think is sort of necessary in a Bond movie to have at least one character with that sort of relationship to him.
Sure. And I mean, I think it's also, it was interesting the way you have both sort of Severine and Solange in Skyfall and Casino Royale, because, you know, mm-hmm. Bond always sleeps with somebody, but there's been this real idea in the last couple of movies that, like, sleeping with him is a death sentence, that if you sort of sleep with him casually, the chances that you will die are almost unnervingly high.
Yeah. You know, it's true that you saw that again in Skyfall. You know, the second that he got on that boat with her, you knew that she was numbered. And I think the jarring thing about Skyfall was how fast it happened.
Yeah.
The scene with Silva in the shooting range, that happened so quickly. It was jarring, to me at least.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's, well, Solange dies fairly quickly in Casino Royale. I mean, she and Bond have the night together. Bond gets the call that her husband is off to cause all sorts of trouble in Miami. There's an action sequence in between that. I guess there is an extended action sequence in Miami in between him returning to the Bahamas and finding her dead. But, and they made the connection, of course, much more explicit. Like, you know, Severine dies in front of Bond. And even if he had managed to sort of shoot the tumbler of whiskey off her head, you sort of get the sense that Silva would have had her killed anyway.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It was a foregone conclusion, for sure.
And I wanted to ask you what you thought of Silva sort of in the context of where Bond villains are, and also just in terms of, like, his sexuality and Bond's sexuality, because I know I enjoyed Javier Bardem's performance as this sort of rogue MI6 agent who's come back to cause everybody a lot of trouble, but I can't mm-hmm. entirely explain sort of why I liked it or exactly how I thought it worked.
Yeah. I am a huge, huge fan of his performance in this movie. I thought it was fantastic. I think he should be on the Oscar shortlist for Best Supporting Actor. I thought, and the reason why, it was so unique and interesting and odd. You know, it's so easy to do a Bond villain and to have the character on paper that he was given and just sort of go completely caricature, histrionic, you know, flamboyant sort of evil with a cackle situation, and he, you know, sort of brought pain into that, and this sort of emotional backstory with M, and, you know, just created this character who, even though he's a very identifiably Bond-esque villain, is just so completely nuanced and just a something that you've never seen in a Bond movie before, and I don't think I've ever seen a villain like that in cinema before.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that struck me as really interesting about him is that part of what's sort of I found compelling about the Craig era in Bond is that I feel like it's the first action franchise, and I say this, you know, 2 days out from having seen Red Dawn, that's figured out how to do villains that are a step beyond the Cold War. Like, Le Chiffre in Casino Royale is a terrorist financier, and that's something that Revenge has picked up on as well. You know, Silva is, I mean, I feel like there's a nod to Julian Assange in there. You can't dye someone's hair that color.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. The cyber terrorist, the bleach blonde hair, of course.
Exactly. But, you know, he's someone who's this very sort of literalized blowback to British imperialism, right? I mean, he's someone who, you know, extended his brief at a time when Britain was ceding power in Hong Kong and was sort of, you know, was very directly sacrificed by M. You know, she says, "I got back six agents and a peaceful transition," when she turned him over to the Chinese, you know, and I think sort of replacing the Cold War and the Russians with sort of blowback to empire as the mm-hmm. sort of more nebulous but kind of more easily variable villain is a really smart thing for the franchise to be doing.
Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, bringing in the cyber terrorism aspect that Silva, you know, sort of that's his attack point, modernizes the Bond film in a way that's completely necessary. Because you're right, that Cold War villain, the, you know, the evil Russian, that kind of thing, you know, towards the tail end of the Brosnan days, was just getting old and cliched and boring, and this brought a whole new. This gives Bond a way to move into the future and to remain relevant going forward, which I think was a necessary move for the franchise.
Yeah. It does require, yeah, and I mean, I think it, in a way, the cyber stuff is also smart because it's a move away, I mean, it necessitates a move away from sort of big, stupid weapons, and to a certain extent, it's a dodge, right, because Silva just sort of says that he can do all of these things, and we don't really need to see them happen, right, I mean, oh my god, he got inside the MI6 network, and now doors, they're opening, it's wild, the idea that he needed to, like, get into MI6 and then do all of that instead of just, like, showing up and shooting M at a hearing seems a little much to me. But in a way, it's just, like, it's a way of sort of leapfrogging the, like, stupid tech stuff that mm-hmm. Ben Whishaw's Q makes so much fun of.
But I also think it made the Bond movie scarier in a way that I haven't seen a Bond movie be in a while because, you know, cyber terrorism and attacking through technology is really frightening, relevant stuff right now.
Mm.
And you know, when Silva hacked that the agent list and posted their locations, you know, that was a terrifying thing. And I think that bringing the Bond villain in that direction, you know, sort of adds this extra element of horror and fright that was missing for a while.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. Well, and it's also interesting to have sort of, I feel like the movie sort of draws upon a lot of different kinds of terrors, right? I mean, you have the mm-hmm. sort of, the idea that a video of someone getting executed is something that we have straight up experienced. It's not some, like, magic weapon from the past. It's not sort of an overblown fantasy of a Russian invasion. Like, Daniel Pearl got killed on camera. This is a thing that happens to people. You also have this sort of, you know, the sort of ruined island, which I guess Business Insider found out what the real island was that Silva took over by pretending that there had been a chemical attack. You know, you have this literally sort of Ozymandian ruin. I feel like it's visually the movie got at a lot of different kinds of anxiety and terror in ways that mm-hmm. are relatively grounded in sort of who we are and what we're actually dealing with.
Mm-hmm. And you know, another way this movie sort of, you know, dealt with who we are, what we're dealing with, was, I think you brought up before, the vague sexuality of Silva and that relationship with Bond. This is one of the first times that I can remember a Bond villain having such a sexualized presence and sexualized energy on screen, and I think it humanized him in a way that I haven't seen a Bond villain be in a while. But it also changed the dynamic between the villains and Bond in a way that, again, you know, that dynamic had been getting boring. And, you know, this is a 23rd film, so sort of adding this ambiguous sexual element to it, you know, is the villain attracted to Bond? You know, how does Bond react to that attraction? It's this sort of new thing to play with in the relationship between the two, which I really enjoyed.
Well, I mean, the sort of specifics of that were very interestingly dynamic to me, right? Because, you know, Silva has this great line. He's telling the story about rats on an island that have been retrained to eat only rats. And he compares himself and Bond to the final two rats. He says, you know, we could eat each other. You know, we could. It could be fun.
Yeah.
I'm just saying. And Bond bluffs him out of it. He's like, you know, he says, what makes you think it's my first time? He sort of implies that he slept with a man before, which, you know, is both squarely in the British boarding school tradition and, you know, a good thing to have on the table. But he's visibly nervous, right? I mean, there is there's a sense of, oh, God, am I going to have to go through with this? It's like, and seeing Bond as sort of sexually behind the times is actually really fascinating.
I actually got the chance to talk to Javier Bardem about his character, and he had a really interesting response to this whole media hoopla about, you know, is Bond gay? Is there some sort of sexual relationship between Silva and Bond? And he said his goal was always to create a character that would make Bond uncomfortable. And he thinks that Silva is a character who would, you know, sleep with anybody. He's just a sexual predator, just in the way that he's a predator in every other aspect of his life. And using that sexuality to make Bond uncomfortable was just another weapon he had in his tool belt. And whether or not that sexual attraction between the two was real is something for audiences to decide for themselves, and he hoped that everyone had a different interpretation about it. And I thought that's really true. The sexual relationship between them was more than just about sex. It was about Silva making Bond feel as uncomfortable as possible, and I think you succeeded if that was his goal.
That's a fascinating insight, especially because sort of Bond's sexuality has been a very direct target in a number of these movies. Like when Bond is tortured in Casino Royale, the target is his genitals, right? It's like there's been this sort of attack on Bond's control of his sexuality in this iteration of the franchise. He's still a seducer, but he's no longer completely at ease. I mean, he, you know, may to a certain extent even be damaged, as is some of the implication in Casino Royale, that you have this conversation with Vesper Lynn. It's like, whatever I am, whatever's left of me, I'm yours. I think that's a really fascinating observation from Bardem, because I think it's, you know, so much of the essence of Bond is that he's in control, right? And I think that's a fairly typical male power fantasy, right? That, like, you can just get whatever you want, you're in control all the time. And to sort of question that is really sort of brilliant.
Yeah, and in Skyfall, it wasn't just his sexuality that Bond was questioning. It was, you know, whether he was in top form again, whether he could actually, you know, succeed the way he had in the past. You know, that was the whole arc of the film, that was Bond trying to get his mojo back.
I thought it was so brilliant to give us an inverse training sequence, right? Because that's something that is a staple of superhero movies, but that we've never seen in the Bond franchise before. I thought that was so smart.
Yeah. And then to have M sort of fudge it for him was another way to give us this sort of insight into a relationship that we haven't had seen before. That M really does care for him in a motherly sort of way, that she'll fudge his records in order to get him back in the field and put her own job on the line again.
Well, and I wanted to talk about Ralph Fiennes, Mallory, who's going to be the new M, because I don't know if you've read, there's this great Jean Le Carré line where he calls James Bond an international gangster, someone who's sort of without a political context. And one of the things I thought this movie did really well was sort of bring Bond into a political context. It's in Casino Royale, we know that she's being called into a hearing, but we don't actually see the scene. Here in Skyfall, we actually see her appearing before Parliament, trying to provide sort of a political justification for the strategy. Human intelligence matters because the world is confusing, the conflicts aren't necessarily sort of ideological in a bipolar way. And sort of the reconciliation, I feel like there are sort of two things happening here. Like, Bond is being reconciled to a political context, but the sort of ideological world that, like, Carré wrote about, that, you know, created that really clear political bifurcation, is also gone. And, you know, it's sort of the movie is kind of an answer to the British sort of bureaucratic spy craft tradition, which is very rich in, like, Carré's work and elsewhere. And, you know, Mallory is an interesting bridge between that. He is a politician, he is civilian oversight for M, but he was also in the military, and by the end of the movie has come over to sort of work in the security state himself.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I see parallels between, you know, that sort of arc of the film and what's happening now with the Petraeus CIA scandal, you know, where you have this organization that, you know, people who are in it and even, you know, people like us who are outside it want to have blind faith that it's pure and is doing its job to the best of its ability and isn't corrupt and there's nothing, there's no moral or, you know, ethical anything that's stopping them from doing their job to the best of their abilities. But at the same time, they have to be held accountable to standards, and it's a job of other politicians to, you know, keep those organizations in line, even if they might be impeding what could be their ultimate progress. And so I think that, you know, that's just another way, having that arc, having that Ray Fiennes character, was just another way of modernizing, you know, Bond that we haven't seen before.
Yeah. It's also just, you know, I feel like as much as it's sort of a reconciliation of Bond to this political context, it's also, I mean, it's a gorgeous movie. I think it may be the prettiest Bond movie ever.
Yeah.
And it's a real, you know, I mean, I think so much of our conversation about sort of action movies and superhero movies in particular over the past, you know, decade or so has kind of assumed this bifurcation between, you know, art and commerce. And Skyfall is just sort of vigorous. I mean, it's sort of like the, you know, in literature, the debate over whether genre fiction is literature.
Right.
And Bond, this Skyfall in particular, is this just sort of vigorous rebuke to that distinction.
Yeah, no, I'm sort of loving this trend right now we're having of these action movies that, you know, we used to have Transformers and Clash of the Titans, which was just crap effects there to show you explosions, you know, in the whole Michael Bay era.
Mm-hmm.
And now we have with, you know, with Skyfall and The Dark Knight Rises and The Avengers, we have these action films that are spectacular looking and dazzling, you know, in the classic way that, you know, Indiana Jones was dazzling, Star Wars was dazzling. These are just beautiful films to look at. You know, like the mansion got set on fire in Skyfall is just one of the prettiest scenes I've seen in so long.
Sure.
And Dark Knight Rises, the football field collapsing in itself wasn't just a special effect for a special effect's sake. It was, you know, a jaw-dropping, cinematically beautiful scene.
Mm.
The same in The Avengers, that whole last battle in New York City, which I think lasted for like 30 minutes in the film, was just gorgeous.
The action snob in me would pull out The Avengers from that list, if only because I think that I am not as crazy about that final battle sequence, if only because I have some very specific tastes in action choreography that did not entirely live up to for me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Skyfall, though, really feels like a movie. I mean, I really feel like Skyfall is distinct from even those two movies in that the cinematography is as important as sort of the second unit direction, right? And in something like the sequence in Shanghai, where Bond goes to kill an assassin who defeated him in the opening action sequence, and the fight between the two of them is, you know, juxtaposed against these projections that are of jellyfish on a Shanghai sort of apartment / office complex that hasn't quite been completed. And you can't see either man's face. The way they're lit, it's just their bodies. It's like shadow puppets. And something like that is just this sort of beautiful marriage of like second unit action direction and cinematography, right? I mean, I just thought that in particular was so strong.
Yeah. I mean, Bond is synonymous with style, and, you know, I feel like, especially during those last few Pierce Brosnan films, the movies became less and less stylish and more just scattershot explosion and special effects. And I think the fact that Skyfall is so cinematically beautiful and the cinematography is so great and those scenes are so gorgeous to look at is part of why people are praising this particular Bond movie so much. It's because it returns to that notion that Bond should be just stylish, and his Skyfall is just a really stylish, beautiful film.
Well, and it's also the kind of movie that is going to look better, is going to look 15 times better big. And, you know, especially as we're approaching Oscar season, which was one of the things that we wanted to think about, one of the things I'm thinking about more and more is, you know, sort of giving credit to movies that play better on a big screen. And there are not very many of them, you know. There's just not that much stuff that's really built for big anymore. And some of that is that, you know, our TVs got bigger, and so the difference has collapsed a little bit. But, you know, I can't think of that much stuff that I think it made a big difference to me to see it on a big screen this year. Beast of the Southern, I think Beast of the Southern Wild, I felt that way.
Yeah, I mean, I know you didn't like the film, and certainly I don't think it should be in the Oscar conversation, but the Avengers.
Oh, I like the Avengers in many, many ways. I just don't love that final action sequence. Just geek caveat so I don't get hunted down.
Okay, gotcha. Sorry. but I think the Avengers is another movie that I could not imagine watching on my TV, but I was first in line to go see it at the movies because I heard just how great the movie looked on the big screen. And I actually think coming up, I'm really excited for the fact that there are so many movies that I can't wait to buy a movie ticket to go see. With Life of Pi, I can't wait to see what that looks like in the movie theater. I think Les Miserables is going to be gorgeous on the big screen, and I think that you'll get so much more out of it by seeing it in theaters than you will if you see it on a smaller TV.
I feel that way about Lincoln to a certain extent, just because it's got such a sort of patinaed palette that I think that there are going to be a lot of details that are sort of flattened and erased on smaller screens.
Yeah. I could definitely see Lincoln being with those movies that if you rent it, you end up snoozing for a little bit. Not because it's boring, but because of the color palette and all those intricate details that are so gorgeous on the big screen are completely lost if you see it in smaller scale.
So cinematography aside, sort of what are the best movies? What are the movies that you think deserve to be in the Oscar conversation this year? Because I feel like there's the will be in the conversation and a million people talk about that. Vulture can assess the likelihood of that till the cows come home. But what do you think, what really got to you? What should be there?
Well, Beast of Southern Wild, I was floored by. It shocked me. How great I thought.
When did you see it? Did you see it at a festival? Did you see it just in theaters over the summer?
I saw it in theaters over the summer. So I already had heard all the glowing reviews coming out of the festivals, which I find for me is often a bad thing because I go in with lofty expectations and they're almost never met. But this is just a movie that met it was everything I hoped it would be, but also completely surprising.
I mean, I feel like that, without question, is both, it's sort of at this intersection of quality of execution and originality of ideas, and I think it's got a higher intersection of those two things than any other movie I saw this year. For folks who haven't seen it, and you should get on it if possible because it's amazing, Beasts is a sort of ultra-low-budget fantasy about a little girl living outside, basically outside the levees in Louisiana before a storm like Hurricane Katrina hits. And I mean, it's basically a story about a 6-year-old superhero, and it's unbelievable. It looks so good. It is, I mean, it's just this sort of totally perspectively different movie that you'll see about sort of poverty or global interconnection or anything else. I mean, I saw it at Sundance. When the Buzzford had like sort of started to build, they added a second critic screening, which they do for the really successful stuff. And it was the kind of thing where, you know, Sundance is an awesome thing to do, but it's also cold and involves a lot of long lines. And you get into this movie theater and you're just sort of in this post-apocalyptic bayou. And it's a totally transporting movie. It really just takes you someplace else. And that for me is really rare.
And I think it's one of those movies that knowing its backstory makes you appreciate it all that more. And I think people should know the backstory of its shoestring budget. All local actors, but both Hush Puppy and her father had never been in a major movie before.
Had either of them acted before at all? I'm not sure either of them have.
I know Hush Puppy had, and I don't want to say that equivocally about the father because he might have. But just like knowing that backstory and knowing the sort of, you know, the underdog status this movie has makes it even more phenomenal, and all that more impressive.
Mm. What else is on your list?
One thing that I don't think is going to get the Oscar attention that it deserves is Perks of Being a Wallflower.
Mm.
I was thrilled by the movie. It was moving. It was perfectly paced. The acting was spectacular. It was a coming-of-age story done well, that I, in a way that I haven't seen in a long time. I thought it was perfectly, it stayed perfect to the book. I just really, really enjoyed the film. I haven't met anyone who did it like it. It's another thing which is rare for movies that are in the Oscar conversation. They're typically very polarizing. I haven't talked to someone who didn't like Perks of Being a Wallflower yet.
That also seemed to me to be a movie that's sort of a showcase for new talent. It's, you know, it's Ezra mm-hmm. Miller, it's Emma Watson, it's, you know, kind of these actors who are going to be in the Oscar conversation, I think, like, all the time
yeah.
in
May
six
Whitman.
Or 7 years. Yeah.
May Whitman should get every award for TV and Parenthood, for acting in Perks of Being a Wallflower. She should get May Whitman.
Yeah. I feel like the movie, for me, like that will get no Oscar attention because I think nobody understood it, is Spike Lee's Red Hook Summer, which I just loved and then remain totally confused about why people hated it. I mean, I don't, you know, I think, and I really bluntly straight up think that part of its reception challenge was that it bowed at Sundance after Spike Lee said some frank and very true things about sort of race
yeah.
in the movie business, and people freaked out and decided that this was sort of a race movie in a fundamental way, and it just sort of never had a chance as a result. But it's this, I mean, it's this incredibly sort of dense drama about living in Red Hook, a neighborhood that, you know, has suffered greatly after being hit by Hurricane Sandy, which is yet another reason for people to go see it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's this just, like, incredibly dense little drama about a, you know, basically basement church in Red Hook, and both the people who go there, the kids who are dragged there unwillingly, the neighbor lady who gets pissed off when two African-American kids keep scratching their names into the cement outside her house, the guy who runs a summer program. It's just, I mean, it's this really, you know, it's this sort of 3-hour-long, very intimate movie about a neighborhood that has this really, you know, horrible conclusion that I think people thought was gimmicky, but I thought was this illustration of sort of both how quickly tragedy can invade a very ordinary setting and also just sort of how quickly people can make their peace around it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also just gorgeous. I mean, it's shot in a couple different styles, one sort of more naturalistically, a second that's supposed to be footage shown through the camera and an iPod and sort of heavily Instagrammed and edited as, you know, a tween would do if they were making
right.
a documentary about their summer. I mean, it's one of the sort of smartest political movies of the year. And again, it got no credit because Spike Lee is an angry black man and we can't
yeah.
appreciate
you're right,
it.
You're right. The backlash against the movie was huge. I mean, that was always reading about in the premiere.
It was bizarre.
Yeah.
How did you feel about Lincoln, which I feel like is just the most obvious, overwhelming Oscar bait
I liked it better than War Horse, which is good.
Progress.
It's one of the movies I left thinking that I enjoyed it, but watching it was tiring. I thought it was beautifully written. Daniel Day-Lewis is as astonishing as everyone expects him to be.
Mm.
It sort of felt like a really long episode of The West Wing, like Civil War edition. And I'm not a West Wing fan, so it's not exactly a bad thing. It's one of those movies you see the trailer for and you think this is going to be a long political drama. It's gonna take effort to get through, and that's exactly what it was. It was executed as well as you expect it to be. But it was sort of arduous to watch. It was very, the palette was very dark. You know, the action scenes were few and far between. You know, trying to peek into Daniel Day-Lewis's sunken eyes was, you know, took a lot of effort because they were so sunken. But, you know, it was a well-done movie. It deserves to be in the Oscar conversation. It's going to get nominated. And like I said, at least it's better than War Horse was.
See, I feel a little, I mean, I think I, I think you and I have arrived at similar conclusions about sort of Lincoln's overall viability and interestingness, but through totally different routes. Because I'm a giant process nerd, and watching Tommy Lee Jones, I'm watching Tommy Lee Jones, David Strathern, John Hawkes, James Spader, of all people, basically piece together a coalition to pass the 13th Amendment in the House of Representatives. Mm-hmm. I just thought it was straight up fascinating. It's, you know, it's a great story about the rise of modern lobbying. You have Walton Goggins as a stand-in for, you know, craven Southern Democrats who have lost their mm-hmm. seats. And Walton Goggins, BTW, can we just talk about what a year that man is having? He is on a roll. But so I loved all of the nerdy process stuff. I thought the Lincoln mm-hmm. stuff was mostly really boring and emotionally inert. I mean, Daniel Day-Lewis is doing an incredible impersonation, but he's doing an impersonation. Like, Lincoln isn't mm-hmm. a person. He is a repository of folksy anecdotes and oratory who has never done wrong by anyone ever. I just thought it was so dull. So dull.
See, Daniel Day-Lewis's performance is actually the part that I was most shocked by, because I was expecting, you know, an impersonation, you know, sort of Meryl Streep in the Iron Lady style. And I thought I got more of a human than I bargained for. Like, I definitely thought there was more nuance and more... I thought it was a more personalized performance than I was expecting, even from him.
I mean, it's not like the impression is amazing, you know? It's mm-hmm. amazing, but I just didn't get that much out of it emotionally. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I also thought Sally, like... let me put it this way. I think the Lincoln stuff, more than the legislative process stuff, was hurt by Spielberg being Spielberg, right? So you have a big mm-hmm. argument between Mary Lincoln and Abe, and there's a thunderstorm in the background, and it's dramatically lit. I mean, you mm-hmm. literally have Abe Lincoln, like, appearing in the candle flame at his own deathbed. Just, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, it's a little much. Yeah. I'm not going to lie, it's a little much.
Yeah, the things that I was moved by, like what you said, was the process. You know, when the bill finally passed at the end, that was the part that moved me. Like, that was the part that brought me to tears. The long screaming match between Lincoln and Mary Todd in the bedroom was supposed to get me that way.
Right.
But I just found it interrupting the action that I cared about most. And I thought Sally Field was atrocious in this movie.
Yeah. I also thought Joseph Gordon-Levitt was just totally wasted. I mean, I thought if they had cut everything but the legislative fight and just focused on that really closely, like, the moment when Tommy Lee Jones, who's playing Thaddeus Stevens, this is the best Thaddeus Stevens biopic ever, when he takes the bill home to his housekeeper and mistress, and she's reading it to him in bed, you could have just ended the movie there, right?
Like, right. That, why didn't it end there? That drove me insane. I thought for sure I was, like, packing up my bag and putting my coat on, and the movie went off for 20 minutes.
I know. It was just like, and so Lincoln's going to ride around, and there's going to be a theater, and just, who cares? Who cares? Yeah. You know?
Totally, popped the momentum bubble right there. I thought that was a terrible move.
Yeah, it was just, I thought it was really unfortunate. And it's a movie that's so full of good little performances. Like, I feel like we haven't talked about David Strathern for Best Supporting, but, like, mm-hmm. as Seward, he's, you know, he's Abraham Lincoln's Secretary of State. He wants to end the war. He does not want to get into a fight for this bill, and he ends up working with these, you know, shady men from Albany, as he puts it.
Right.
And gets really into bribing and bullying all of these Dems. It's really funny. You know, it's a good performance. It's, as a movie about political expediency, it's great, but...
Mm-hmm. What did you think of Sally Field? Because I said before, I found her completely over the top. It's almost like she was acting in a different style of movie.
So it's a hard role, right? And I think that one of the things that has been... One of the things that's challenging for her in that role is that the bar's been raised really high for people with mental illness in pop mm-hmm. culture. Like, when Claire Danes is off doing her, like, bipolar Carrie Matheson thing, you can't just, like, be moaning all of the time and have people expect that to be nuanced, right? I did think that the scene that works really well is her going toe-to-toe with Stevens, who held congressional investigations into her spending on the White House.
Mm-hmm.
And there she gets to be a person. Otherwise, she's just a collection of ticks and moans.
Right.
And,
yeah, when the finger started twitching the very first scene, which is like, here we go.
Yeah. Like,
Then, and the screaming, to me, it just seemed like one of her brothers and sisters' monologues with a southern accent.
Yeah.
I thought she was woefully miscast in that role.
She's super shticky. There's nothing to it. And to be fair, there's not that much for her in the script either. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's not a role that's gives a lot of understanding to like hysteria and women's illness.
Yeah.
And all of this other stuff. So it's a.
She's getting so much buzz for it, though, which is just confusing to me.
Well.
I don't see it at all.
I mean, the Oscar machine is sort of irretrievably broken, I think.
Yeah.
And it's hard, you know, I mean, there's all of this little stuff that I feel like. And, you know, stuff from different genres. The idea that something has to be sort of big and sweeping and ginormous to be in Best Picture contention is mm-hmm. exhausting. Like, Beast of the Southern Wild, again, I love it, but it's like, you know, an epochal. It's just like a ginormous epochal, my brain isn't working, like post-apocalyptic story, you know, it's an epic, everything is epic,
I think you're bringing up a good point about, you know, something big having to go into the Oscar conversation, because, you know, another thing I wanted to bring up, this is a really interesting year. You know, in 2010, they rewrote the Best Picture nomination rules and expanded the category to 10. And the reason was because The Dark Knight wasn't nominated.
Yeah.
And now this year we have The Dark Knight Rises, which for all intents and purposes was as rapturously reviewed as The Dark Knight was. And it's sort of missing from the conversation this year. Like, this was, you know, if this is a year that The Dark Knight rules is tested most explicitly with The Dark Knight Rises, it's sort of failing. Because that movie has sort of been missing from the conversation. It sort of fizzled right after it premiered.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it was nearly as good as The Dark Knight. You know, I thought it was sort of a mess. But, and, you know, I mean, it's sort of like John Hamm never winning an Emmy for playing Don Draper. I don't think Christian Bale is ever going to win an actor for playing win Best Actor for playing Bruce Wayne. And I'm not even really sure.
Absolutely not. But you know, a superhero movie that I think is done as brilliantly as The Dark Knight Rises was, I think, should be in the Best Picture conversation. Because, you know, there's more than... Best Picture shouldn't be defined by, you know, these sort of art house standards that have been sort of dominating for these past few years, which is, again, like, why they expanded the category to 10 nominees.
Sure.
And I just find it really interesting that the reason why it was expanded was because of The Dark Knight snub and this year The Dark Knight Rises was released. And, you know, for the most part, got reviews that were as winning as The Dark Knight got, and it's just missing from the conversation completely.
Yeah, another movie that is sort of, again, is kind of a response to this idea that everything that's Oscar-worthy has to be sort of epic, and that I feel like was in the conversation and has since faded some, is The Sessions with John Hawks mm-hmm. and Helen Hunt. And Hawks plays a character based on a real person, Mark O'Brien, a journalist with polio who spent much of his life living in an iron lung, and his character is in his mid-30s and decides that it's time for him to lose his virginity. And sort of with mental counseling from a Catholic priest, played by William H. Macy, help from his caregiver, who I think is Moon Bloodgood, and then with a surrogate, you know, a woman he hires to work with him on his sexual issues, played by Helen Hunt, finally succeeds in losing his virginity. And it has a somewhat treacly end that I thought could have been cut. But it's a really funny movie, and I feel like mm-hmm. comedies have just been, you know, and I think, like, it's honestly, I think, much more of a straight-up comedy than it is a dramedy.
No, I agree. But I was surprised by how funny it was.
Right, it's hilarious, right? Like, William H. Macy gets to be very funny, which he doesn't always get to do anymore. Like, the stuff about sex is really frank and funny in an adult way, not in a, like, oh my god, there are penises and vaginas, oh my god, everything is hilarious, mm-hmm. but in a... You know, like, sex is funny. The things that humans' bodies do are hilarious. You know, in a sort of looking at them straightforwardly kind of way.
Right.
Yeah, I just thought it was a great movie and sort of not Oscar-baity except for the fact that Hawks is playing someone with a disability who is not a particularly right. typical person with a disability. Like, he's funny, he's profane, he's sexual. I don't know.
I mean, I'm happy that it is in the conversation because of that, because I think John Hawks and Helen Hunt are outstanding in it, and I would almost guarantee at this point that both of them will end up with Oscar nods.
I hope so.
Yeah.
Sort of fingers crossed.
Yeah, but funny films, that's why I'm really excited for Silver Linings Playbook. From everything that I've heard, it's absolutely fantastic and heartfelt and also really funny.
I just want Jennifer Lawrence, who stars in Silver Linings Playbook, as a goth widow. That seems to be the standard descriptor going around. I just adore her, and I want her to have the best career ever, and hugs and puppies. I just think she's great.
After the Kristen Stewart, you know, misfire, getting the when she was cast as that lead in Twilight, I'm so happy that, you know, with Jennifer Lawrence as Katniss, we finally have this sort of energetic.
Well, we have someone who's in one of these major roles without seeming to be driven insane by it, right? I mean, Lawrence has a boyfriend who is not either Team Gale or Team PETA.
Exactly.
She gets to be a real human.
And she seems to be enjoying her life in a way that Kristen Stewart has so maddeningly not been for these past, you know, however many years.
I feel for Kristen Stewart. I mean, I feel like she's a sort of cranky introvert who is suddenly super famous and she's not dealing with it particularly well, but there's not really much of a mechanism, particularly when you're in something like, you know, Twilight, to accept that. But it's hard.
It's true. But I do think Jennifer Lawrence is handling it all much better. And plus, she was phenomenal in the Hunger Games. You know, I'm one of those nerds who read all three books in a day and a half, and she was everything I had hoped she would be in that movie.
Yeah.
And I thought her performance was perfect.
Yeah, no, I think I really think she's great. I just, fingers crossed, I'm hoping to see Silver Linings Playbook this weekend, so we will see what happens. We've been talking a lot about things that aren't getting the attention that they deserve, and I wanted to pivot from that to our third subject, which is a television show that, in my humble opinion, 40 million people should be watching, which is ABC's awesome country, like, soap, Nashville.
Yes.
I love this show so much. I am completely obsessed with it. It is the story of an older country singer, Raina James, who's played by Friday Night Lights as Connie Britton, who is sort of trying to rebrand herself, particularly as a younger singer, Juliet Barnes, played by Hayden Panettiere, is kind of nipping down her heels. But it's a great political drama starring Powers Booth from Deadwood and Robert Wisdom from The Wire. It's just it's this big, really sexy grown-up show that is, I don't know what grown-ups are doing at 10 o'clock, apparently not watching television. But I'm so sorry that people are sort of taking a miss on this one.
Yeah, it's quickly become my favorite hour of TV, which has surprised me, actually. And I think I'm actually a good case study for that, because had I not, you know, been in the entertainment journalism universe and read all those rapturous reviews before it premiered, the trailer that ABC was showing made this look like nothing that I wanted to see.
Right, it was like sort of catfighty, and, you know, the graphics were terrible. I mean, do we really need a throne made out of guitars? I know Game of Thrones is a thing. It's a thing I love and that I write about a lot, but not everything.
Yeah, it looked like a sort of cheap amalgamation of Dallas and, you know,
Smash.
Soap and with a little bit of Smash. Yeah, it looked like nothing I wanted to see. It looked corny and cliched, but it's so good. So I can sort of understand why people who aren't hearing how good it is haven't given it a try yet. But they really, really should, because it's surprisingly good.
I mean, one of the things that's been amazing to me, of all the musicals on television, I think it's just head and shoulders above everything else. And that's because Callie Curry, who created the show, is married to T-Bone Burnett, who's basically been going through the back catalog of country music and saying, hey, you know, our people should cover this or that. And so there are all of these just astonishing songs on the show. You know, something like Fade Into You, this song that is performed by these two characters who are sort of trying to get a deal writing country songs. I mean, that is an unbelievable song. That should be, you know, at the top of the country charts. And I feel like they're discovering and, you know, in a way creating royalty opportunities for a lot of country artists in a way that, you know, is sort of an admirable use of that business model.
And I think one of the most brilliant aspects of the show is the way it sort of contrasts old world country that, you know, sort of Connie Britton's character is supposed to embody, and then the sort of new pop Taylor Swift world that Hayden Panettiere's character, you know, is a part of. And the songs that both sing are good songs. Like, for a country pop song, the Hayden Panettiere songs, even though they're made fun of by, you know, Connie Britton's character, they're actually very good. I could hear them on the radio if they were released right now.
Yeah.
And the way that, you know, the music team has drawn the distinction between those two lines of country music, I think is, you know, extremely well executed. And both John and neither side is unpleasant to listen to. Both are being done just really, really well.
I will say, I think Juliet's songs are, like, actually less poppy than Taylor Swift's songs at this point, right? Mm-hmm. Like, this is not stuff that Max Martin is turning out in a lab. Like, I think Taylor Swift is essentially a pop artist at this point and not really a country artist anymore.
But definitely the Carrie Underwood sort of thing, where she gets the same flack for being too poppy. I could definitely hear Carrie Underwood singing one of Juliet Barnes' songs.
Yeah. And it's also, it's a show where nobody is just, like, cartoonishly evil, right? I mean, mm-hmm. everybody's problems are real sort of grown-up problems. You know, Juliet is sort of obnoxious and a little bit impulsive, but she also has a mother who's a really serious drug addict. You know, Raina can be sort of capricious. She has what she calls diva dips, which I think is such a great term. But, you know, she's earned her bones, you know, in the business. She's supported her family. She puts up with her extremely difficult father. The men have finally started to come into focus. And it took a while since a lot of them look alike.
Yeah, it's true. But they're sort of all replaceable.
Yeah. But it's interesting to me because it's the kind of show, it feels very much like ABC responding to the fact that networks keep getting shut out of the Emmy drama nominations, right? I mean, this is a show that's smart. It's really rooted in process, which is something that mm-hmm. sort of the best cable shows are, and that network shows have really sort of understood. You know, the characters are grown-ups. The female characters are really good. Like, it sort of got the jump on cable to a certain extent in that respect. And yet, nobody is watching it or really almost any network TV this fall.
I know.
Kind of a disaster. You know,
I feel like it needed a bigger opening, a bigger and more buzz than it has right now if it hoped to make it into the Emmy conversation. I feel like if The Good Wife was shut out last year with all of the, you know, critical accolades it was getting, that, you know, Nashville doesn't stand a chance, or a show like Parenthood, which in my opinion should be at the top of the drama list.
Yeah.
You know, it won't get it either. I think we're at the, where 10 years ago everyone was talking about the death of network comedy, which, you know, which is wholly untrue now. We have, you know, more strong comedies on TV than anyone can stand to watch. I think right now we're having that same problem with drama, where, you know, the cable drama is just overshadowing completely, and the Emmys, you know, won't respond to networks the way that they used to.
Well, and I think networks in a really tough place, right? Because CBS sort of built this brand on being not too challenging, on being comfort food. And, mm-hmm. you know, people who watch cable dramas have convinced themselves that, like, network is just not worth it, right? That, you know. Right. And so networks are trying to do all of the right things, but they're confronting this sort of credibility gap. It's hard, you know. I mean, people chased CBS for so long and put so much dumb trash on the air. And even CBS isn't doing well trying to be smarter. You know, the ratings for Vegas are not very good, even though I think that's a relatively smart, handsome show. It's, mm-hmm. And it's hard. I mean, I feel like so much of what I do as a critic is be like, guys, really, please just watch this thing. You'll like it, I swear. And I feel like so much of the time I'm offering people lemon meringue pie and they think I'm giving them vegetables.
Right.
It's
The problem is, it's not cool to watch any network TV shows right now. You know, there's not one network drama that I can think of that when I tell my friends that I watch it, they don't giggle at me.
Right. You know,
I watch Nashville.
Right. And there was NBC's Thursday Night Comedy Block, and that was the closest thing, and it's basically gone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's true. It's sad. And I think it's more so true for dramas than it is for comedy. I think, you know, New Girl has some sort of cachet going for it, and the Mindy Project as well, even though the ratings for New Project are terrible. But I think the network drama, like, you know, you tell someone you watch Nashville, or you tell them you watch Revenge, or Once Upon a Time, or something like that, and you get laughed at.
Yeah. Well, you know, I guess the thing to watch is Revolution, which is proof that you can never cast a lead too pretty or too unable to act. And if there are big set pieces and swords, the people will come.
This is true.
Well, I guess we'll all have to look forward to catching up on movies and, you know, maybe in this fallow period as TV takes a break, the Oscar race will lift our hopes. We'll just have to see. And in the meantime, everyone should go see Skyfall.
Yes, absolutely. It's very, very good.
Well, look, thanks so much for joining me, Kevin. I really appreciate it.
It was a pleasure. I was happy to do it.